Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. Got another Patrick McManus. This one's going to be from Never Sniff a Gift Fish. But let's see. Today's the 6th of May. You know, I decided I'm no longer a fan of May. Since I'm not really an avid turkey hunter, there's not a lot for me to look forward to there. And I decided that just like the anticipation, which is not a fun anticipation, it's more of an anxiety of waiting for tag or draw results for tags, it just sucks. I'm kind of a planner, so I like to, you know, kind of plan what I've got coming, even if it is something that changes. I'm adaptable and can, you know, roll with the punches, but I like to know what I've got ahead of me. And of course, when it's something like that's as heavily anticipated as, you know, hunting, then I definitely want to know what I'm, you know, all what I'm building towards and practicing for all year, and what, you know, the one thing that I most look forward to all year long, what that is, and whether I'm going to get a tag to do it. And man, just the anxiety of the tags and the draws, I'm not even talking about like the once in a lifetime ones. I basically write those off and don't even put them in my orbit. But just like, you know, the deer tags where you have, you know, maybe a 1 in 2 or 1 in 3 chance, or even a higher chance, but there's that little chance that maybe you're not going to get it. Oh man, that drives me crazy. And it just happens that, you know, results for most of them come out like at the end of May or beginning of June. And so, you know, where like this year, I think Nevada, they bumped the deadline and they extended it into the first week of May. And so once you know, put in, then that's where that anticipation for me really starts. And so the whole month of May is like just this waiting. And in this day and age where there's computers, it's like, why can't they just notify, you know, drawing deadline for Nevada was May 4th at 11 p.m. Why not just let us know on May 5th? All they got to do is hit enter, you know, on the computer and spit out the results. It's not like they're waiting for, you know, mail-in applications anymore. Well, I don't think they are, but maybe that's why. If they're still accepting mail-in applications and they have to manually enter it all, but geez, does that even happen anymore? I don't know. I can't wait for the day when the deadline, you know, happens and then the results are known the next day. Not going to come soon enough. Might as well use this technology if we're going to invent it, right? So today we are going to read the Christmas Hatchet, which kind of funny because I can almost tell the direction this is going to go, like not in a good way. I got a chainsaw for my birthday when I was in sixth grade, and it's kind of funny, you know, I was like all excited being a country kid to have my own chainsaw. But man, what a genius gift to give your kid, right, as a parent, that, you know, how much enthusiasm is your, what was I, sixth grade, you're going to be what, 12? How much enthusiasm is a 12-year-old going to have to go and cut a whole bunch of firewood when they have their own saw, right? Yeah, that was smart on my parents' behalf. And it was funny, my dad got a log splitter, but it wasn't until after both of his boys had graduated from high school and moved away, and there went his two log splitters. So then he finally buys one. Tell you, parents are a lot more savvy than kids give them credit for. Anyway, we're on to the Christmas Hatchet. The best evidence I've been able to come up with that the human race is increasing in intelligence is that parents no longer give their kids hatchets for Christmas. When I was a boy, the hatchet was a Christmas gift commonly bestowed upon male children. In an attempt to cover up their lapse of sanity, parents would tell their offspring, "Don't chop anything." By the time this warning was out of the parents' mouths, the kids would have already whacked two branches off the Christmas tree and be adding a second set of notches to one of his new Lincoln logs. It was not that the kid harbored a gene compelling him to be destructive. The problem was with a hatchet, which had a will of its own. As soon as the kid activated it by grasping the handle, the hatchet took charge of his mental processes and pretty much ran the whole show from then on. Shortly after Christmas, the kid would be making frequent trips to the woodshed with his father, and not to chop wood either. "The hatchet did it," the kid would yell as he was being dragged toward the woodshed by his shirt collar. "I was just walking through the gate and my hatchet leaped out and chopped the post." Some kids were gullible enough to try the old George Washington cherry tree ploy. "I did it with my own little hatchet," they would confess. "I know," their father would say. "Now haul your rear end out to the woodshed." The moral most of my friends and I drew from the cherry tree story wasn't that George Washington was so honest, but that his father was a bit slow. This showed that even a kid with a dumb father could grow up to be president. The average length of time a kid was allowed to remain in possession of his hatchet was 48 hours. By then, the hatchet would have produced approximately 60 bushels of wood chips, 800 hack marks, and a bad case of hysteria for the kid's mother. The youngster would be unceremoniously stripped of his hatchet, even as its blade fell hungrily on a clothesline post or utility pole, or would be told that he could have it back when he was older, which was meant at age 27. Kids now probably wouldn't understand the appeal of hatchets held for youngsters of my generation. If a kid today received a hatchet for Christmas, he would ask, "Where do you put the batteries?" He would have no inkling of the romance of the hatchet and what it symbolized to boys of an earlier time, presumably all the way back to George Washington. In the time and place of my childhood, woodcraft still loomed large in the scheme of a man's life. A man sawed and split firewood for the home, of course, but more important, he could take care of himself in the woods. He could build log cabins and lean-tos and footbridges, chop up a log to feed a campfire, fell poles to pitch a tent or to hoist up a deer, or to make a stretcher to haul out of the woods the person who wasn't that good with his axe. One of the best things you could say about a man back then was that he was a good woodsman. Being a good woodsman seemed to erase a lot of other character flaws. Shorty may have some faults, one man might say, but I'll tell you this, he's a good woodsman. Yep, someone else would observe, Shorty is a fine woodsman, all right. If he made it to the mountains, I'll reckon it'll take the posse a month to root him out. The axe was the primary tool of the woodsman. If he wished, a woodsman could go off into the woods with an axe and provide heat and shelter for himself and live a life of freedom and independence and dignity and not be at anyone's beck and call or to have to comb his hair or take baths. Not that I recall anyone ever fleeing to the woods, not even Shorty, who was nabbed by sitting on a bar stool at Beaky's Tavern, still a long ways from the mountains. But it was the idea. If you were good with an axe and a gun, of course, and a knife, you could always fall back to the mountains. What it was all about underneath was the potential for freedom, not the jived-up freedom of patriotic speeches, but real freedom, one-to-one ratio freedom, where man plucks his living directly from nature. Of course, sometimes nature plucks back, but that's not part of this dream, this vision, as symbolized by the Christmas hatchet. I first realized I needed a hatchet when I was 5 years old, and my mother read me stories about the pioneers chopping out little clearings in the great forests of the land. I thought, how satisfying it would be to chop out a clearing, to chop anything for that matter. My campaign for a hatchet began immediately and achieved fruition on my 8th Christmas. Although I wasn't allowed to touch any of the presents before Christmas Eve, I had spotted one package that bore the general shape of a hatchet. Still, I couldn't be sure, because my mother was a clever and deceptive woman, once wrapping a new pair of long johns to look like an electric train. Was she pulling a fast one on me this time, or had she truly lost her senses and bought me a hatchet? It turned out to be a hatchet, a little red job with a hefty handle and a cutting edge dull as a licorice stick. Even as I unwrapped it, I could feel all the thousands of little chops throbbing about inside, pleading to be turned loose on the world. "Now don't chop anything," my mother said. Within minutes, I had honed a razor edge onto the hatchet and was overcome with a terrible compulsion to chop. 48 hours later, the hatchet was wrenched from my grasp and hidden away, presumably to be returned to me sometime after I had children of my own. A few days after Christmas, I had learned that my friend Crazy Eddie Molden, who lived on the farm next to ours, also received a Christmas hatchet. "Where is it?" I asked. "Let's go chop something." "I got it put away," Crazy Eddie said. "Let's use yours." "I loaned mine to my cousin for a while," I replied. He said, "You don't have a hatchet I can borrow, do you?" And I said, "Sure." "Sure," said Crazy Eddie, who was only crazy part of the time. As good luck would have it, an epidemic of permissiveness swept through the county the following summer, and both Eddie and I regained possession of our respective hatchets. There were still plenty of chops left in the hatchets, and the two of us wandered off down to our woodlot in search of a suitable recipient. A large tamarack soared up uselessly on the edge of the woodlot, and Crazy Eddie said that maybe it would be a good idea if we built an empty space in the sky where it was standing. As it happened, I had long nourished my desire to yell, "Timber!" at the very moment I sent a mammoth of the forest crashing to the ground. "Your folks can use it for firewood," Crazy Eddie said, in an attempt to explain his motive for felling the tamarack. But I knew he too yearned to hear the thunder of a great tree dashed to earth. He, as much as I, was into chopping for the pure aesthetics of the thing. We spent all day chopping away at the tamarack, with Eddie on one side and me on the other, our hatchets sounding like slow but determined woodpeckers. At noon, I went home for lunch. "What are you boys up to?" my mother asked with a no great show of interest. "Chopping down a big tree." "That's nice," Mom said. "Don't fight." After lunch, Crazy Eddie and I were back at the tree again, chipping out a huge U-shaped gouge on its way around its circumference. We were both exhausted, sweating, standing in our chips up to our knees, but we could see now it was possible to accomplish the task we had set for ourselves. The tree began to moan and creak ominously as the hatchets bit into its heartwood. By late afternoon, the huge tamarack stood precariously balanced on a gnawed core of wood slightly thicker than a hatchet handle. Neither Crazy Eddie nor I had the slightest clue as to the direction in which the great tree might fall, which heightened our anticipation with the added element of suspense. We took turns charging up to the tree, whacking it a good chip, and then dashing back to relative safety. Suddenly we heard it, the faint, soft sigh that signaled the tree's unconditional surrender to our Christmas hatchets. A silence fell upon the land. High above us, the boughs of the tamarack rustled. Crazy Eddie and I shivered happily. We had accomplished something momentous. Crack! Went the tree, beginning a slow tilt. We were now able to determine the direction of its fall, which wasn't particularly good. Eddie's father, a short while before, had built a fence between our woodlot and theirs, and now, even though I had not yet studied plane geometry, I was able to calculate with considerable accuracy that the tree would neatly intersect the fence at right angles. "You better yell, Timber!" Crazy Eddie said, his voice trembling. "Tim!" I started to cry. Then we heard another cry. It was that of Crazy Eddie's father, who had come down to the woodlot to call him in to supper. "Eddie!" his father called. "Crazy Eddie! It's time for supper!" Crack! Went the tree. "Eddie!" went Eddie's father. "Eddie!" The monstrous tamarack smote the earth with a thunderous roar, rising above which was the twanging hum of barbed wire. Fence posts shot into the air 50 yards away. Eddie's father shot into the air 50 feet away. Bleep a bleep bleep of a bleep, screamed Eddie's father, introducing me to that quaint expression for the first time. There is an old saying that cutting firewood warms you twice, once when you chop it and once when you burn it. Well, chopping down that tamarack warmed Eddie and me three times, and one of those warmings was a good deal hotter than when the wood burned. I learned a good many things from felling that tamarack with my Christmas hatchet, perhaps the most interesting of which is that a barbed wire fence is regarded by its builder as merely a barbed wire fence until a tree falls on it. Afterward, it is looked upon as a priceless work of art, surpassed in beauty and grandeur only by the Taj Mahal. My Christmas hatchet disappeared immediately after the great tree felling, but surfaced again a few years later when I was old enough to conduct my own camping trips. Much to my surprise, I discovered the hatchet was almost useless for cutting wood. It was as if Excalibur had been reduced to a putty knife. The very next Christmas, I gave my little cousin Delbert the hatchet as a present. "Wow," he said, "a real hatchet of my own? Thanks a lot." "You're welcome," I shouted after him as he raced away, homing in on a stand of shrubs in his backyard. "But don't chop anything." All right. That concludes our McManus read. And if you have kids, perhaps the Christmas hatchet is not such a good idea. I know I had one, and I whacked plenty of things that shouldn't have been. All right. Look forward to the next one.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support. I come down.